This is Understanding Israel-Palestine. I'm Margot Patterson, the producer of this week's episode. It focuses on the threat of mass expulsions facing Palestinians in firing zone 918. But first, news. On June 15th, an Israeli court found a Gaza aid worker guilty of multiple terrorism charges, though his employer and an independent investigation found no evidence of wrongdoing. Mohammed El Halabi, the Gaza director for the international Christian charity World Vision, was arrested in 2016 and accused of diverting millions of dollars to the Islamic militant group Hamas. He has been held in detention ever since. In the wake of Mr. Halabi's arrest, World Vision and several of its major government donors, including the United States and Australia, commissioned an investigation. It was led by a global law firm and accompanied by an accounting firm's audit. A spokeswoman for the group said they could not find any evidence of diversion of funds or any connection between Mr. Halabi and Hamas. World Vision and human rights groups say Mr. Halabi was denied a fair and transparent trial. In May, a decades-long legal battle ended with the Israeli Supreme Court ruling that Palestinians living in an area in the South Hebron Hills in the occupied West Bank could be forcibly expelled from their homes to make way for an Israeli firing zone. The ruling affects some 1,200 Palestinians living in the Masafer Yatta region and paves the way for what could be the biggest mass expulsion of Palestinians since the Six-Day War in 1967. Their case goes back to 1980 when the Israeli Defense Forces declared the area a closed military zone known as Firing Zone 918. The residents have been in court for the last 22 years trying to remain in their homes. They were allowed to stay, but barred from building new structures while the case was pending. Here to talk about the situation is Roy Yellen, Director of Public Outreach for the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, which documents human rights abuses in the occupied Palestinian territories. Roy Yellen, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Roy, tell us what's happening now that the Israeli Supreme Court has ruled that the Israeli Defense Forces can expel residents living in 8 of the 12 villages in Masafer Yatta. I know there have already been home demolitions by the Israeli military that your organization has documented. How quickly is Israel moving? What are you seeing on the ground there?
First of all, I want to put the changes on the ground in context. We have seen demolition action, but we've seen demolitions all over the years during the time the court proceedings were ongoing. We're also seeing other measures that Israel is taking in order to create coercive environment and to forcibly transfer the population seemingly out of their own volition, but actually it's because of making their life conditions unbearable. What is new is that now if those residents are actually leaving because of those conditions, this will constitute a war crime. What is new is that now this war crime has the stamp of approval of the Israeli Supreme Court. We're fearful that it will allow for increased measures. But I would really like to stress that this has been ongoing and that it's not restricted only to Masafer Yatta, where there are about 1,000 people that are living in the communities that are within the firing zone. But it's also true for other Palestinians living in areas that Israel is interested in taking over, like the Jordan Valley, the areas surrounding Jerusalem, in the direction of the Dead Sea, and some areas in the northern West Bank. Just yesterday evening, residents of some of the communities received a notification from the Israeli army that they intend to do live fire training in the area. So I hope that doesn't affect them and that nobody is asked to leave their homes for the duration of this training drill. But it just shows that the army has intentions of now using the area for training. And this is just like one measure that is intended to make the residents leave their homes and lands.
Well, let me ask you about international law. The Fourth Geneva Convention prohibits the transfer of populations living under foreign military occupation. What did the Israeli Supreme Court say about that?
The ruling is actually saying two things which are untrue. First of all, they say that this binding treaty, which is considered to be customary law, customary meaning that a state or a country doesn't need to ratify the treaty for it to be in effect. First, they said that this specific prohibition is not customary. And second, they said that the military commander of the area stands above those instructions, and that those instructions are intended to be just for the forcible transfer of many people for political or other reasons. Of course, it's untrue. This is a binding, whether the state ratified or did not ratify this treaty. And of course, that this prohibition is relevant even for a single person. It doesn't have to be large numbers. It doesn't have to be entire communities, as we see here. It applies to everyone, every protected populations. The only thing that is permissible is to tell civilian populations to take refuge for pressing security needs for their own protections, which of course is not the case here.
As you're pointing out, there's a lot of background to this situation. There's historical background, there's legal background, there's cultural background that's relevant too. Can you talk a little bit about the communities living in Muzaffar Yatta? Much of the court's decision seemed to hinge on whether they were seasonal dwellers or permanent residents. If you could, give us a sense of the land there and the people living there and their occupations.
So Muzaffar Yatta means Yatta surrounding. Yatta is the big city of this district, of the area in South Hebron Hills. Those small communities are shepherding, herding, or making living out of agriculture in those lands. It started when Yatta became bigger and bigger, and some of the people that resided there took their herds during the winter months and lived in caves that they built in the hills. Following that, and before Israel even arrived to the area, they built permanent communities, which are clearly marked in aerial photographs from the 40s and 50s. They made a living out of herding sheep, goats, and growing wheat and other produce. The court actually claims that they don't reside there, that they're not permanent residents. Our interpretation is actually that it doesn't even matter whether they're permanent or not. They are permanent, but that has nothing to do with their right to be there and to have a safe and secure lives wherever they want to build their houses.
The president of the U.S.-based rabbinic human rights group, TRUA, was quoted in an article in the Jerusalem Post saying that the demolition and removal projects are, quote, in violation of any human rights law. And it also honestly defies logic because it doesn't help Israel. It doesn't help Jews. All it's doing is destroying people's lives, close quote. That was Rabbi Jill Jacobs, president of TRUA. Why does Israel even want this land?
Because it creates a larger barrier. It's the Israel from the very outset of the occupation of the West Bank marked several areas where there were sparse communities of Palestinians that it decided to take over. It constructed settlements and tried to push those Palestinians away from those areas. It's clear that you can't forcibly displace large communities like Yatta, but the smaller communities, Israel at least considered them to be unorganized and having no support, they seem like an easier target. And the purpose of the entire Israeli regime in the West Bank is take over Palestinian land and hand it over to the hands of Jews. This is part of and parcel of the apartheid regime that Israel enacts. And therefore, Israel saw fit to use several means to make those people leave. Actually, it all started in the 80s when, in a government protocol, the Israeli then Minister of Defense, Ariel Sharon, later became Israel's prime minister, told the army, why don't you declare a firing zone in that area for the purpose of making sure that Palestinians don't stay there? And this is exactly what Israel did. together with other means like a prohibition on constructing new structures, denying connectivity to electric and water infrastructures, continue ongoing confiscation of property, and other means.
So these people are living in very rough, primitive conditions, I take it, unconnected to the water grid or electricity.
Actually, they are now connected to micro networks. They have water filters and they have solar panels or wind propellers to generate electricity, thanks to a wonderful NGO that is called Comet Me. And they are making sure that the residents of those communities have what is needed, despite Israel denying connection to the, you know, to the general grids that every settlement or illegal outpost in the area enjoy. They're doing an incredible job in helping those communities. Now they even have a pilot for connectivity to internet services. It's just incredible.
The United Nations and European Union condemned the Israeli court ruling and urged Israel to stop the demolitions and evictions. Quote, the establishment of a firing zone cannot be considered an imperative military reason. Imperative military reason is in single quotes, to transfer the population under occupation. Close quote, the EU spokesman said in a statement. Are these condemnations having any effect on the Israeli public? What's the response of the Israeli public to this ruling?
First of all, I don't think that it's a matter for the Israeli public to be persuaded or dissuaded. It's a matter of respecting the human rights of the people that are living there and have no political voice to participate in this decision making. So that's like just to make it sure, to make sure that I don't think that it's up for us Jews living, residing in Israel to decide the fate of people that are not part of our political decision making. I think it has little effect because words are cheap. And if there are no concrete consequences to those condemnations, then Israel knows that it can continue to do what it does and what it has been doing for the past few decades with no real repercussions. There should be consequences to severe violations of international law, but so far, those are not in the horizon.
Various activist groups have brought attention to what's going on in Mosafer Yatta with a Save Mosafer Yatta campaign. How many activists are there in the area and are they having an effect?
Of course, they're having an effect because they are able to generate interest and draw the attention of the public here and internationally. But I would also say that the people of those communities are very well organized to make their own voices heard. They have been conducting fantastic protests. They're documenting the Israeli measures by themselves using their own voices. It's also a local and very, very impressive community that is trying to really hold on to its land and to protect their way of life and their future.
What's going on in Mosafer Yatta is getting a lot of attention, even from some people in the United States Congress. Why is this expulsion getting that attention? As you pointed out, Israel has been confiscating Palestinian land and demolishing Palestinian homes for many years now. What is it about this case that seems so salient to people?
It's just so wrong. You see the people that are living there really like barely making a living there, holding on to their lands and trying to leave peacefully. They are impressively, their fight against what Israel is doing to them is nonviolent. It's about justice and about every human being can instinctively understand that is something that you really need to support. I think there's also like a larger context internationally of seeing what the Russian occupation of Ukraine is doing. And we have to make those analogies in our minds and think like, why do we think this is wrong and we allow this to happen? And especially if we're talking in the context of North America, a lot of it is happening with the bankrolling of the American administration and support. The other reason is probably the fact that we now have a bigger understanding of what Israel is doing and the context. following Amnesty's Human Rights Watch, our and various Palestinian organizations report about the Israeli regime as a regime of apartheid, we have an understanding of what Israel is trying to do and for what purposes. And we understand that this is not about a future negotiation about a two-state solution, but rather as the story of one group trying to dominate another, disenfranchised, and using various means of violence and legislation that is just oppressive and unjust.
I know there was one demonstration June 10th when a protester was injured by Jewish settlers throwing stones at them. I think two actually were injured. Are there protests going on every day? And in addition to the Palestinian residents, whom you're pointing out are putting up a very courageous struggle against eviction, how many activists are on the ground helping draw attention to their situation?
The demonstrations are weekly, usually during on Friday or Saturday, so people can come. This area is not readily accessible. It's far off. It takes, I think, roughly 2 hours to get there from the center of Israel. So it's an effort to go to those protests, yet dozens of people arrive on a weekly basis to participate. Perhaps this is helping those communities to know that they have some solidarity and that they're not alone. I'm not sure how long they can sustain this because Israel has all the power. Israel has the might and the forces to do things which are disproportionate. One of the demonstrations in the past few weeks was barred from getting into the area. The army can declare the entire area closed military zones, and then people cannot arrive there. And I think this is something that when that happens on a larger scale, we might have to understand that we have to sound the alarms because the forcible transfer is approaching. Another thing that I want to stress, it's not about putting people on trucks and taking them away. The crime of forcible transfer is about creating coercive environment. And this environment is created not just by the military training, but also by the denial of building permits, by the denial to connect those communities to infrastructure. It's the entire package of measures. It's not just the military training.
Where will these people go when their homes are demolished? Or where do people go? Because some people already have had their homes demolished.
Most of the people there had their homes demolished at least once in the past 20 or so years that this thing has been going on. They stay there. And because the war crime of forcible transfer is a crime of consequence, by staying there, actually the Palestinians are saving Israel from committing this crime. Those people are with really like impressive resolve are rebuilding. They are collecting their destroyed lives and they go back and build again and they stay there and they hold on to what is theirs.
Some have said this expulsion of Palestinians from their homes in Masafer Yatta could be a precursor to widespread annexation in the West Bank and mass expulsions. Are many people viewing this in that light?
I think this entire threat of annexation is a little bit of a boogeyman. Israel is already controlling everything in the West Bank. It's already de facto annexed the West Bank. So this talking about an accession as something that is looming over the future is actually ignoring the reality on the ground. Israel is already there. It does what it does to people that are living there. It makes their life unbearable. And we have to stop it now. We don't have to wait for the future. And we don't need to for this to mark something worse that is going to happen. It's bad enough as it is now.
What could the Biden administration be doing?
I think Biden is coming to the region. So far, what we've heard is that the Americans are asking for a lot of symbolic things for Palestinians, like having Palestinian police present at the border between Jordan and the West Bank, the border crossing. I think it would be much more helpful if the American administration uses its considerable influence over Israel and demand that Israel stop with all the efforts to forcibly displace Palestinians wherever they happen, not only in Masafer Yatta, but also in the Jordan Valley and in the areas around Jerusalem and in East Jerusalem.
Roy Yellen, Director of Public Outreach for the Israeli Human Rights Group at B'Tselem. Roy Yellen, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you.
I want to turn next to Beth Miller, Political Director of JVP Action, the political and advocacy arm for Jewish Voice for Peace, a nonprofit that opposes the Israeli occupation and supports the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, pressuring Israel to end its occupation through nonviolent action. Beth Miller, thank you so much for coming on the program today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Earlier in the program, I was speaking to Roy Yellen, Outreach Director of the Israeli Human Rights Group B'Tselem, about the situation in Masafer Yatta. The Israeli Supreme Court decision and subsequent evictions in that region have led to a much greater expression of concern for Palestinians than we normally see in the U.S. Congress. Why? Usually Congress lines up solidly behind Israel, regardless of what Israel does.
It's a great question. I think that what we're seeing right now in Congress is a shift and a growing power in the progressive wing of the party and a growing political courage in the progressive wing of the party to finally speak out for what, in fact, most Democrats want, which is for the US government to have a foreign policy that is more focused on human rights and justice and less focused on simply having unwavering support for the Israeli government, no matter what it does. And so the result has been that with something like the threat of forced expulsions of over 1,000 Palestinians in Masafer Yatta, the truth is, it's something that is so blatant that Congress can't ignore it, right? And of course, let's be honest, Congress can ignore whatever it wants to ignore. We've seen it happen time and time again. But because there is such a growing demand amongst Americans for there to be a shift and greater justice and fairness in our foreign policy and more of a centering of Palestinian human rights, especially progressives in Congress are realizing that they need to respond to that. So what we've seen is at least 90 Democrats have spoken out in opposition to what's happening in Masafer Yatta. And of them, there's a smaller group of progressive lawmakers who have actually called for tangible, concrete action to be taken to hold the Israeli government accountable for its actions and for what are undeniably war crimes.
And this smaller group of congressional representatives, are these the, I believe, 63 Democratic lawmakers who have written a letter to Secretary of State Antony Blinken?
There was a letter that was signed on to by 83 representatives that was to Secretary Blinken calling for action and opposing the demolitions of Masafer Yatta. And we're so glad that so many Democrats signed on to that letter and supported that letter speaking out, because it was included a lot of Democrats who wouldn't normally, like you said, speak out on something like this. But then there was another letter led by Congresswoman Cori Bush that was signed on to by 15 Democrats in the House. And that letter basically said, let's call this what it is. It's a war crime for them to forcibly displace and demolish the homes of Palestinian residents in occupied territory. And if it goes forward, we as the US should be obligated to track and document which military units are carrying out these war crimes and if US equipment is being used. And accordingly, following US law, take action to stop that support from going forward.
So far, President Biden and his administration have said little about the evictions in Masafer Yatta, other than a very tepid expression of disapproval. Do you have any hope that the Biden administration or President Biden himself will weigh in more forcefully?
President Biden on this issue has been incredibly disappointing time and time again. Not surprisingly, President Biden has had a long political career, and it has always been one where he has failed to act for Palestinian human rights. So it's not a surprise that he hasn't spoken out forcefully on this or on other issues where the Israeli apartheid government has been clearly and blatantly and systematically violating Palestinian human rights. However, I think that where my hope lies is in public pressure and demands, right? The truth is that President Biden is currently planning a trip to visit Israel and to visit Palestine alongside visiting the Saudi Arabian government. He's planning a trip that is quite controversial with very good reason. He's essentially planning a trip to an authoritarian regime and an apartheid regime to try to build relationships between those two. And so it's now on us, the movement, the Palestinian rights movement, to kick up enough outrage about this where there should be outrage and force the Biden administration, especially in this moment where he is about to take a trip to meet with the Israeli government officials who are carrying out war crimes as we speak. Biden needs to feel the pressure and he needs to feel the heat. And that is the thing that will force his hand in actually speaking out more forcefully against this. However, having said that, I don't put hope really in the Biden administration to do the right thing. I think where the hope is in progressive lawmakers in Congress who are more responsive to what Democratic voters really want. And that is where I think we can create and build real tangible change and actual accountability.
For people who are listening to the show, hearing about what's going on in Musafer Yatif for perhaps the first time, what would you like them to do?
The action for them to take is absolutely to pick up the phone and call their members of Congress. They should call their representative in the House and they should call both of their senators. And they should say that as constituents, they want their representatives to stop the unwavering, unconditional, unquestioning flow of military support to the Israeli government and for them to take action to stop Israel from carrying out war crimes against Palestinians in Musafer Yatif. This is not a wait and see situation. Demolitions are already happening. And so it's critical that the members not stop at these letters. That's step one. Next step needs to be following up on the demands of the letters. It is absolutely true that calling your representative when done in mass can really make a difference and they need to hear from them. So that is the action that your listeners should take.
Last question for you, Beth. I know there are activists going to Musafer Yatif to stand with residents there. I've read that many of them are Jewish. I'm sure not all are. Do you know if many activists from your organization, if many U.S. activists in general are going to the occupied West Bank to do this?
I know that there is already a group of activists, like you said, Jewish and non-Jewish and all following the lead of Palestinian residents in Musafer Yatif who are leading the protests, who are leading the struggle against what is happening. And I believe that there was a protest, I think last week, with over 200 activists, both American, Israeli, again, all following the lead of the Palestinian residents who are most impacted by and threatened by what's happening, to show up and protest this. And I do think that that kind of presence can make a real difference. And that's the physical representation of our solidarity, right? Is when there can be folks who show up physically to follow the lead of Palestinian activists who are leading this movement and really, really be there. And that's the kind of thing that can hopefully, if nothing else, drag enough media attention on this, that there can be increased pressure to stop the Israeli government from going forward with this war crime.
Beth Miller, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you so much, Margo, for having me on.
You've been listening to Beth Miller, political director of JVP Action, the political and advocacy arm of Jewish Voice for Peace. Join us again next week for another episode of Understanding Israel-Palestine.